Hello and thanks for joining us for this week's Big Boat interview. In this episode, I caught up with the Turner twins, Ross and Hugo, who are midway through a six-week, 100% emission-free sailing expedition to what they call the Atlantic Pole of Inaccessibility. During the expedition, the twins have been gathering valuable data to contribute to research on clearing up plastic in our oceans, as well as testing out various bits of sustainable kit on board. They told me how it had all performed and shared some valuable advice for keeping calm when things don't go your way. Hi there, guys. So thanks for joining us. It's a very, very hot day here in London, but it looks very hot where you are as well. You're both reclining on a boat somewhere. Where are you and what are you doing?
Hi. So we are in northern Spain in a marina in La Coruña, waiting for a weather window to sail back to the UK.
Right. It's meant to be boiling there, is it not? What are the temperatures like where you are?
Well, I think they're in the early 30s, but there's a sea breeze and we've kind of acclimatized because we've been down here for a good week or two. So, yeah, I hear it's pretty hot in England.
It is indeed, and not acclimatized being a pasty Londoner. But anyway, so maybe we can start off by you introducing yourselves a bit. Your website calls you professional adventurers. So I wondered, is that how you kind of view yourselves, or how would you describe what you do?
I would describe ourselves as professional adventurers. By default, we get paid to go on adventures. So I haven't found a better word for it yet. So if anyone can come up with something more.
I think we should just call ourselves adventurers, because you don't see or hear like, I'm a professional lawyer or I'm a professional doctor. It's rhetorical.
Well, I guess you don't want to be mistaken as an amateur adventurer, kind of bungler.
Yeah. I think it's in our profession, it's quite hard to be full time. So I think from that standpoint, professional adventurers is kind of encapsulates who we are and kind of what we stand for.
Okay, that makes sense. So I'm realising as we're talking that, so Hugo and Ross are both here, and it's going to be reasonably difficult to ascertain who's speaking at what time, given you both have quite similar voices. So you might have to kind of tag in as you answer these. So maybe Hugo, you could take this first question, which is just sort of, how did you get into this line of work? Because obviously you've got what some people would consider a dream job. So how has this all come about?
Well, it all came about, we're 33 now, and when I was 17, I broke my neck, which put a stop to my, you know, sporting career, but, you know, just being even able to play any sport. And so that whole aspect of my life was taken away. Obviously, with a broken neck, you can't really play many sports after that, and you've got to be reasonably careful. And then we went to Loughborough University, where a couple of friends wanted to row the Atlantic, and this was back in 2010. And we fortunately, as a result of my injury, managed to raise enough money for the project through a charity called Spinal Research. So had it not have been for my injury, then we would never have rowed the Atlantic and therefore set off on this pretty unusual career path.
What an amazing way to turn something, you know, something I imagine very frightening and scary into a positive. Did it feel very frightening at the time? Because you broke it diving, didn't you? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I broke it in a diving accident down in Cornwall. So we were after work, going for a swim after work. And it was just a simple freak diving accident, running in from the beach, Baywatch style, should we say. So I wasn't being irresponsible. I was being very responsible. Hit a sandbank under the water, dived too deep, and had a compression fracture of C7.
And can you still go underwater and things now, or do you mainly have to stay kind of above the surface because of that?
No, I mean, I'm absolutely fine now, other than just daily neck pain and lack of movement in my neck. But other than that, it's been a full recovery, which has been really, really fortunate.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, so that was your first thing, was kind of rowing the Atlantic. And maybe just for the benefit of people listening and a bit of background, before we go on to talk about your more recent
recent expedition. Maybe Ross, you could kind of outline what some of the most exciting expeditions and adventures you've had so far, what they've been, particularly the kind of more marine focused ones.
Yeah, we've, I say this particular one, the Atlantic Pole of Inaccessibility, is like the next marine one on from rowing the Atlantic, due to COVID and lockdown restrictions. I think a couple of years ago when we started looking at our next expedition, COVID was obviously a big thing in the news and restrictions all over the world were lifting and going into lockdown at different paces and times. So we just thought there's no point in putting a huge amount of time, effort and money into these land-based expeditions when it could easily be cancelled. So we thought let's look to do a trip on the water. And so we started planning this project 7 years ago. And then we started doing it seriously a couple of years ago. And then we got lucky with a couple of sponsors, which funded a huge majority of it, or at least bought the boat. And then we kind of went from there. But in between this and our very first rowing the Atlantic, we've done electric motorbikes across Europe. We've cycled across North and South America to the poles of inaccessibility out there. And then the first pole of inaccessibility we did was in Australia, where we flew paramotors from Adelaide all the way to the very centre point, which is the Red Centre. It's been very varied. We certainly like doing trips and expeditions and modes of transport that we've never done before, which is good, but it does add a little bit of stress to the projects as well.
Yeah, of course, because you're kind of, you know, you're learning a new mode every time. But it's interesting that you kind of started looking at expeditions at sea as a kind of more viable way of doing something adventurous over COVID, because obviously we know lots of superyacht owners are doing more and more adventurous travel and COVID's attracted a whole new host of people over this period because of that reason. So have you found it easier in terms of logistics, planning, permits and things, or is it just that, you know, it was easier because it was open air and it wasn't a specific territory?
No, I think it's certainly been easier. When we've got into the marinas, there have been no kind of formal checks for COVID vaccinations or COVID passports, etc. I think because you're at sea for an extended period of time going from one country to the other, you're self-isolating anyway. So I think there's a bit of sensibleness and common sense happening at the ports, which is great. So now in terms of making it easier, it's been a lot easier than traveling across borders, which has been really nice.
And so let's outline a bit about what you've been doing more recently.
We're currently on a project to reach the blue pole of inaccessibility, which we've coined the name because it's the center point of the Atlantic, or the pole of inaccessibility. This is the point defined as being the furthest from any coastline, so the furthest you can get from any, island. So it's slap bang right in the middle of the Atlantic. If you drew a line, across from, let's say the Canaries, Azores to the Caribbean. So somewhere in between those two. And really the focus is testing a load of sustainable technology that we've put on our Class 40 yacht, namely a fully electric, propulsion system and a new anti-foul system on the hull. And then we've been supporting a plastic research survey for Plymouth University's International Marine Litter Research Unit. We're helping a PhD student calibrate the Sentinel 2 satellite looking at macroplastic buildup in the North Atlantic. And amazingly, we had obviously preconceptions about how much plastic we thought we would see or expected to see. And we didn't think that there'd be a lot, but we're seeing big items of plastic. So, they've asked us to look at anything bigger than a bottle, really. So we have been seeing several large pieces of plastic every single day. And so we're logging those for the data capture seats, but also the B&G systems on board, which are our navigation. They've been really helpful to just put in waypoints, track, and you put your notes in and things like that. So you can then take it all off those B&G screens. So that's what we've been doing. So we're continuing to do some the plastic research as we make our way back to the UK, and we've also got an Argo buoy from Ocean OPS, which is a drifter buoy. So that we will drop that, I think, 60 miles north of our position in Acarunia, which will then over the next several years feed back data to the weather systems. So that will be temperature, salinity, wave height, temperature. So scientific buoy of the back. So that's really what it's really focused on is you know, supporting the research from Plymouth University and then testing these new technologies.
It sounds like you've got some fantastic kit on board. So of the things that you're testing out, like you say, the anti-fouling, and I think the boat's powered by hydrogen, you know, has everything worked how you expected it to? Has some things performed better? Are there some things that you think, okay, that tech's not quite there yet? How is it all kind of fared in practice?
It's the hydrogen side of it is happening for the UK tour. So we are, just to say clarity, this is only an electric powered sail drive engine for the Atlantic sail, the hydrogen part, which is kind of prototype generator. That'll be meeting us at each port around the UK. So we don't see any issues with that. We've still got to plug it in and test, but that will be the hydrogen side of it. In terms of performance, it's a little slower than a diesel engine, and the range is obviously considerably lower. But for getting in and out of port, absolutely fine. There is no issue. All you've got to balance up is the limitations. You obviously can't go as far as a diesel engine. So if the wind is far offshore, then you've obviously got to wait for that weather window or the weather to come closer to you. But all in all, it's I believe there's only 300 engines or electric ocean vaults have been fitted to boats, and we're certainly kind of pushing the boundaries of what this class 40 racing yacht can do. The Finsulate, which is, we were actually really excited about this. This is a new anti-foul product that's been on the market for a couple of years now, but is still yet to take a firm hold. It's basically a carpet that you stick on the underside of the boat, and it acts like a sea urchin skin, and so nothing really sticks to it. If you do get fouling or buildup of algae or seaweed on it, you literally just brush it off. So nothing's going in the water. You think about how many litres of toxic anti-foul go on the bottom of each boat, and then that obviously falls off into marinas and onto the beaches, etc. It must be thousands of tons a year go straight into the water. And with this, after 5 to 7 years, you just take it off and you can put it in the bin, recycle it, so it doesn't go in the water. So
it's great to hear these kind of reviews firsthand of how things are working. And I did wonder, from all the other expeditions and stuff you've done, what bits of kit do you really rate? You know, if you're telling, you know, there are adventurers, lots of our owners do stuff on land as well as in the mountains, just like you have, and the desert and all sorts of things. What things do you think, yeah, that's worth the money, or that's something we rely on time and time again?
One thing that's been on our pretty much every journey is a tracker. So we've got a yellow brick tracker, or I think they're called YB trackers now. I think tracker's just a really helpful way of, you know, all your friends and family and followers to track where you're going. So not really a piece of kit, but it's, you know, it's really useful for getting those, you know, people interacting and following the trip virtually, because ultimately you're away for a few weeks at a time, and you know, all you see is a couple of updates on social media and a phone call. You got a satellite phone. Iridium satellite phone is always like really handy, always staying connected. Because ultimately things go wrong, plans change. You know, a nice phone call at the top of a mountain is always very motivating. And then really it's trying, you know, trying not to change your kit system just before you go. You know, having an old rucksack is going to be far more comfortable than a brand new one that you go out and buy, because obviously you're used to the old one, how it works, it fits your back. You know, that goes the same for, you know, trainers, any shoes, walking boots. But you know, down jacket is ultimately probably the most versatile piece of kit you've got. You know, it's a perfect all-rounder, although lots of people seem to think when it's raining they put down jackets on, which I find really funny.
And because you know, you sort of talk about you know, you sort of had this idea to go adventuring and then you both went adventuring. But there's obviously a kind of step in between there where you learn how to cope with these challenges and how to operate the kit and everything like that. Where's that come from? Have you learned that together as you've gone along, or have you done other experience that has kind of equipped you to do this sort of thing?
We grew up on Dartmoor and we didn't have a TV to it 8 years old, so we just went out into the garden and then the garden became Dartmoor, and we've kind of expanded ever since then. So we've spent probably the best part of 20 years outdoors messing around, and you do start curating your kit and understanding what works for you, what doesn't for you on weekend trips, 4 day, 5 day, week long trips, and then obviously the longer ones. We're practical. I say we're fairly practical. So that's obviously helped with what we do. We were pretty sporty at school. So going from sailing to cycling to flying to motorbiking, it all kind of, I say, thankfully, it sits in our repertoire of skills quite well. So it's certainly been learnt over many years, and anything we don't know, we're quick learners, and you do find a way of learning it. And I think that's true of anyone. You know, if you want to learn a new skill, go and do something. If you do it for a week or two, you certainly become pretty savvy at it.
And you mentioned earlier, or you've referenced a couple of times, the weather, actually. And I know that was a bit of an issue for you recently. So you kind of set off to start this Blue Pole project and then you had some difficulties, didn't you? Can you outline kind of what happened?
Yeah, so we started from Southampton and headed out into a strong, strong headwind, 30 knot headwind. And that made certainly the first 24 hours, 48 hours on the boat trying to get down towards Plymouth Way, or at least Cornwall Way, quite difficult. We had a breakage on the first day, and then we had another ballast break on the second part of the leg down to Southampton. I say from Southampton before we went across the channel. And that delayed us. And with sailing, you have quite fine sailing windows to get across. And this morning we were up at 5 o'clock. We were out ready to cross the Bay of Biscay and the wind didn't develop. It said it was going to be 8 to 12 knots of wind. And we sat there till about 11, 12 o'clock and there was only 2 to 3 knots of wind. So we had to come back. We had to come back in, because with an electric engine, there's only so much range you have. There are a number of sailing boats that were motor sailing past us. And with diesel engines, you can do 300-400 miles. It doesn't matter at 6 knots. Whereas we have 12 knots at about 3 to 4 knots. So we're very, very much smaller range and quite bespoke in what we can go out in. And so we're going to go back out again tomorrow and hopefully try and catch the weather enough to push us off the coast and then head for France. But the weather's been, I think, quite peculiar. We haven't really spoken to anyone, whether they're a local in the particular country we're in or a yachty, so to speak, who said this is fairly normal. You know, the southwest is meant to have southwesterly winds, and at the moment all you're experiencing is northwesterlies or very, very hot weather. So yeah. I wouldn't say anything over the last month has been ordinary at all. So we're fighting the elements. But as I was saying to the team this morning when we were doing more weather routing, we all know sailing works because we've done it for thousands of years. But what we're testing, and we really are having to test it because of the weather, is the electric engine part. You know, why are not more people taking up this new sustainable mode of transport? And it certainly has its limitations, but if you work within those limitations, it can be very rewarding.
Because that was going to be one of my questions. You know, we know that certainly in super yachting, there's a lot of electric stuff coming out, be it electric tenders or kind of yachts where you can switch between diesel electric or all sorts of things like that. And listening to what you're saying, you know, hearing other motor yachts and sailing yachts kind of whizzing past you must be frustrating. How far off it being a more kind of more popular solution do you think it is, or do you think we're there and owners just have to adjust their mindset?
I think there's probably a bit of both. I think we are there. I mean, the infrastructure on the boat, it's very simple to change from a diesel into a full electric system, because it essentially uses the same sail drive on an existing boat, so it's really almost a plug and play, as they say. So that's easy. Wow. The transition is easy, but the issue is the mindset and trying to adjust to, you know, this new idea of actually you don't have infinite, you know, diesel on a boat. It's you've got a limited amount of miles that you can travel on the electric motor. I mean, you're a sailing boat after all, which is ironic because we're really struggling to, you know, find the winds. But yeah, it is. It's very much a case of having to adjust your mindset and having to, you know, just really think about things differently, sail differently. You know, the infrastructure is there. But yeah, hopefully, you know, with the add-ons of hydrogen fuel coming, you know, they're just starting to become a bit more apparent from a consumer perspective. So hopefully that will make an inroad into the marine industry.
And what do you think the key is to changing people's mindsets? Because I can imagine lots of owners thinking kind of, you know, lots of them are very sustainability minded and want to make changes, but they're also kind of time poor. And I think lots of people will be thinking, well, I can't afford to spend 3 days waiting for the right weather. This isn't the right solution for me. So what do you think is the key to kind of convincing people to change the way they sail, to change the way they travel when they're at sea?
Well, that's a very difficult question because there's so many different variables and everyone's different and everyone sails differently. I think obviously cost comes into it. If you look at the engine, the fully electric engine we've got in to a brand new kind of diesel alternative, fairly similar in cost. So you could argue to say the cost is, you know, negligible. It doesn't really matter. Obviously range, you're going to get a huge amount more range on a diesel than you would electric. And that therefore you're going to have to change the way you sail. And I think for most people, they're used to sailing with a diesel and that's the way they want it. And going electric certainly has advantages, but also disadvantages. So it's up to that particular person whether they do or don't want it and how much they sail. You know, if you've got access to the ocean right off the doorstep, fantastic. If you've got an estuary that's, say, 8 to 10 miles long to get out to open water, you're pretty much using all your battery, depending on how many batteries you have, to get out to sea. So you won't be able to get back in just on electric alone. So a few considerations, but it's an interesting one when you put it that way. You know, what's stopping people? And I think it is obviously a huge amount of battery power for not that many miles compared to, say, the equivalent space of a tank of diesel and the miles that would get.
And talking about kind of adventures and things and having little setbacks, whether they're because you're testing out bits of kit or because you're relying on the weather or because of other, you know, all the multiple factors that can affect how things go. How do you think you both cope mentally when kind of these little hurdles come up? And what's the best advice people have given you? And what's the best advice you can give other people when it comes to dealing with the uncertainty and the flexibility really that you need to have in what you do?
I mean, you just got to be open to listening to other people. You've got to surround yourself with people that know what they're talking about and draw from their experience. It's very easy to become arrogant, and because you've planned the whole project and it's your concept and you want to deliver it how you want it to go, it's very easy to get into that mindset. But you've really got to surround yourself with a good team, a good sound panel of friends, advisors, experts in the industry, professionals that you have to listen to, because ultimately you don't have as much experience as they do in whatever, you know, application or trip you're doing. So certainly, you know, we found that, you know, you've got to be flexible with all these things. There's only, I think, only one of our trips has ever gone to plan from start to finish. So you know, and that, you know, that's the nature of, you know, adventures, you know, isn't it? Is that, you know, anything can happen. Ultimately, yes, you want to, you know, come back, but, you know, from when you leave to come back, anything can really happen. So that's what I would say is, you know, surround yourself. But also I think the best piece of advice we've been given, particularly on this project, was, you know, we're speaking to a guy who's very involved in the racing world, in sailing. And we said, you know, the initial plans, we gave him an overview of what they were, and he just said to us, double it. just everything double it. So the boat that we were dreaming of getting, the finance that we needed, the budget, the length of the trip, everything, he was just like, double it. And then as soon as we doubled it, it just felt more achievable as well. So you don't actually know how, you don't realize what you can achieve until somebody says double it, because it's your own goal, as it were. So you think that's just, you think that's your ceiling. So yeah, advice is that if anyone's got a dream, a plan, you know, let's just say sail across the channel, or sail down to the Mediterranean, sail down to the Canaries, Madeira, the Azores, you know, why don't you just double that distance and see where it takes you?
I think that's great advice when it comes to sort of pushing yourself a bit. And what's it like doing all of this together? You know, you've done so much together now. Do you ever think, you know what, I quite fancy going alone and pushing myself, you know, without my brother there? Or does that never even cross your mind and it's not something you'd entertain?
I think one day we might do things separately. I've sailed across the Atlantic without Hugo. But I think the best thing you can do is share it. I can speak for you, Hug. I don't really understand people that go off on big trips alone, because you get back to wherever you live and then you're constantly going, go on, talk to me about it. Okay, I'll tell you about it.
Definitely met a few of those, I think. You sometimes feel for the long-suffering friends of people that have done amazing expeditions, because it does come with wanting to talk about it all the time, understandably.
And you don't get that reflection, you know, when you walk down the street or somewhere new and you smell a smell or you hear a song, you go, oh, remember that we were in this bar, or remember that road we were cycling down in the middle of the outback or whatever. That's exactly what I just smelled. And you can bounce off that reflection. Whereas people who do things solo, it's always a bit kind of come back and I'll see who wants to hear me and I'll just chat to them about it. And I guess that's because I'm a twin. I've always had someone to share things with, and I totally appreciate people and understand a little bit why people do things on their own. But I think, yeah, you've got to share it, haven't you? That's what life's all about. That's why pubs are so full in the evening every year, all year, because people are social animals.
And what are each of your strengths and weaknesses? What do you know about the other one that you think, oh, he's not going to cope well with that, or, oh, that's something he does that always winds me up? You know, what things kind of crop up when you've been working on something together for a long time?
We are different with altitude. So I'm not very good with altitude, and Hugo's much better at altitude. But I can cope with the heat much better than Hugo can. So when we were in North America, we had 51, 52 degrees. And I was okay with it, but Hug gets a bit, a little bit more reserved about exercise and that kind of heat. So we have to kind of pull over and stop and hydrate a bit more. And I'm not great with altitude compared to him, so I'm kind of breathing a lot harder than he is. So I don't know why, but...
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? And mentality-wise, what are the kind of differences between you both as, you know, individual people?
I'm quieter than Ross, but Ross is... I don't know, yeah. I just like to quietly just get on with something rather than endlessly talk about it. And I think I'm more of a realist, whereas Ross is an optimist. But that's kind of probably quite a good, you know, balance to have, considering the nature of the work we do. You want something that, you know, we want somebody that goes, yes, it's possible, and someone to go, actually, well, is it?
Yeah, definitely. And what sort of things do you do when you're not kind of adventuring? Is life always just planning the next adventure, thinking about what's just gone on, or do you have other kind of hobbies that are completely left field?
No, I mean, we almost have a 9-to-5 job, in the sense that we are working all day, every day in front of a computer to raise the funds and drum up the next project. That's really the ugly side of what we do, is that, you know, just like most people, we're 7 o'clock up in the morning, and now COVID has put this horrible routine where you get up at 7:15, your computer and laptop's open, and you're checking emails, you know, and that doesn't finish until 7 at night. But no, you know, other than that, it's just, you know, we live in London with our girlfriends, so it's just doing, you know, odd weekends and bit of fishing here, going down to Cornwall. Yeah, I quite like the easy home life.
And I was actually going to ask about your kind of collaborations with brands and things, because I look on your site and see, you know, these amazing campaigns you've done with Land Rover and all this video footage and things. And it's, you know, you look at it and it's incredible. But I do think, God, imagine being, you know, doing an expedition or something, but also trying to worry about, you know, is this going to look good on camera? Is the client going to have got everything they wanted out of this? How do you cope with that? And does it make life much more difficult?
We've learnt. We started off with small expeditions and we're kind of growing and growing in size. Honesty and openness to the brand. I think if there is a big brand involved in a big expedition, we just lay all the truths out and go, look, this is what we're trying to aim for. There will certainly be things that go wrong. There will certainly be things that won't happen. We'll do our best to get this and that. So it's very honest. It's very frank. That's it. I think when you start over-promising and under-delivering, that's when people start getting probably a bit pissed off and going, well, you know. But as long as you're open, I think we're very honest with our brands, and we like them to be honest with us, because then it's a mutual understanding and everyone knows where they stand. And the expectations are that you'll do your best, and if that's all you can do, then perfect. And the story is an authentic one. I think problems happen when you start faking it. Which we try not to do, or hardly have ever done. You know, we might stage a photo, but that's about it, really, just for a front cover. But yeah, honesty and openness.
It makes a lot of sense. So you're on the boat now and you're sailing. Where's kind of what's happening in the near future? And then what expeditions have you got planned when this one is eventually completed?
So right now we... are in northern Spain, and we're waiting for a weather window to get back to the UK, which is, today we tried to leave, but we couldn't get out because of the low winds this morning. So we've come back into port, and now we just need to reset and try again tomorrow morning when we can hopefully find a weather window to get back up to northern France. But then in the English Channel, the wind is completely gone, so obviously being an electric project, we're going to really struggle to get across it. So at this moment, we don't know how we're going to get back to the UK. We'll probably have to stop off at France and then, you know, do it little by little. So that's the immediate future, and then beyond that we're going to take the boat around the UK, visiting 10 port cities, promoting the project, and, you know, hopefully people can come down if they're in the area and learn from the project and have a look around the boat and learn about the technology. And we're working with some amazing partners that will be showing some film screenings. I think there'll be a bar, and people can come on the boat and learn about the project. So that will be over August and September into October.
And then beyond that, do you know what your next step is, or is that kind of in the planning now?
I think hopefully next year, so 2023, we are going to try and get to Madagascar to do the Madagascan Pole of Inaccessibility. That's been in the pipeline for a fair few years, and due to COVID and various other things, it hasn't happened yet. So that will be certainly planning probably a couple of trips to Norway. We are planning to do the Greenland Pole of Inaccessibility, so need to brush up on our kite skiing. And then, it's endlessly trying to work out what the next project is after that.
Well, best of luck with everything. That sounds amazing. Good luck with the rest of the weather. And thanks for speaking to us today.
Thanks for listening to the Big Boat Interview, which is part of the Boat Briefing podcast. The programme is mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Tune in on Fridays to hear all the news from the world of super yachting and our special data reports. And don't forget to like and subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. See you next time.